Two of the 2018 MacArthur Genius Grant Award winners are from Illinois. Here's U of I sociologist Rebecca Sandifer speaking to the MacArthur Foundation.
I think we also want to live in a society where people can have decent, stable, secure, safe lives. And access to justice makes both of those things possible.
Plus, we still struggle to talk about race openly, even in our, quote, diverse communities. That's the subject of the Kartemquin series, America to Me, which follows a year in the life of high schoolers from the Oak Park and River Forest suburban Chicago communities. Here's director Steve James.
People don't really engage in really candid and honest conversations about their real feelings about race because people worry so much about how they will come off if they say something that's at all critical or could be perceived negatively.
That's all coming up on this Encore edition of The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and a belated Happy New Year. Coming up later this hour in this encore edition of The 21st, Academy Award-nominated director Steve James has directed a 10-part series that focuses on Oak Park and River Forest high schools in suburban Chicago. It tackles difficult questions of race, diversity, education. It's called America to Me. But first, every year, as many as half of American households can face a problem like wage garnishment, getting evicted, or losing custody of a child. Those problems are actually legal issues, but many times the people who are affected by them don't have lawyers to help. The issue of who gets access to justice and how we can do a better job of equalizing that is the life's work of sociologist and legal expert Rebecca Sandifer. It's a work that was recognized in 2018 by the MacArthur Foundation with a so-called Genius Grant. The MacArthur Fellows received $625,000 over 5 years. Christina Olson is another 2018 MacArthur Fellow. As a research psychologist at the University of Washington, Christina studies stigmatized populations. The Olson Lab Trans Youth Project is taking a cohort of transgender and gender nonconforming youth and studying these young people over a 20-year period. Christina is an Urbana native but now lives in Washington State. Rebecca works at the U of I in Urbana. I spoke with both of them in 2018, shortly after they won their fellowship. Hi, Christina. Rebecca, welcome to The 21st.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much.
Rebecca, let's start with you. Congratulations, as I said. I imagine you don't know that you don't apply for a MacArthur fellowship. So was it kind of a shock to get that call?
It was a complete shock. And usually they call you, but the program manager for the fellows happened to be on campus because her mother is a U of I alum. And so she was attending an event and she made an appointment to talk to me. And I thought, well, if someone from a foundation wants to talk to you, you should always talk to them. So I made my little talking points about, you know, the important things MacArthur should
ask
be funding.
In case they wanted to ask you, like, maybe they'll give me money.
And so she listened to me really politely for a few minutes, and then she said, can I shut the door? And she told me, and I was absolutely stunned. It's just not something that you expect.
Christina, what about you? How did you find out?
My experience was a little different. I saw my phone had calls from the same number over and over, and I assumed this was just a really persistent spammer. And then I noticed it was from Chicago, and I just ignored it. And then at some point, that same spammer called my work number, and I thought, how does a spammer know my personal cell phone number and my work number? So finally, I just decided, wait, maybe it's an emergency. Maybe someone I know is hurt. So I answered it, and the first thing the voice said was, are you in a room where no one can hear you? And I thought, that's not the normal.
That was the first thing they said before they even said hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think they might have said hello and are you in a place where... so I moved to another room and then they kind of said, do you know what the MacArthur Foundation is and what the MacArthur Fellows are? And I said, of course. And they said, you know, you're one. And I just kind of freaked out.
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, it's a call that is a great call to get. And I think in a few minutes, I'm going to ask you about what you are planning to do with the fellowship. But I wanted to just ask you guys about the work that you're doing. And Rebecca, I wondered if I could start with you And I think everyone kind of knows if you're in the criminal justice system, you're entitled to legal representation, right?
Yes. Yeah. If you're at risk of being incarcerated, then the state has to provide you a lawyer, even if you can't afford one.
And then what about for the criminal, for the civil justice system?
So it's really interesting. So on the civil side, you could have a foreclosure problem, which could mean that you could lose your house, or an eviction, you could lose your apartment. You could lose custody of your kids. You could lose access to your health care. You could lose your job. So these are really serious things that are core to all of our lives. But you don't have any entitlement to legal assistance when you face those kinds of legal problems. There's a tiny office funded by the federal government that puts some civil legal aid lawyers out in the country, but there are far too few of them to serve the people who need them.
And I guess this is obviously very different depending on how much money you have.
Yes. So the federal guidelines for access to these subsidized legal services are 125% of poverty or below. So that's about 60 million people in this country. Almost 20% of the population is that low income in our country. And they're served by about 6,000 federally funded lawyers.
So across the entire country?
Across the entire country.
Did you say 20 million people?
60 million people. Eligible for the services of about 6,000 lawyers.
So when people hear that there's legal aid clinics or pro bono services, that's not really covering it at this point?
No. I mean, there are lawyers who volunteer their time, and there are law students who work under supervision to assist people with their justice problems. But there's no way that all that effort can provide enough assistance to the people who need it.
And so in your research, you talk about how when someone has a problem like this and they're poor or they're lower income, if they have a problem with eviction or health problems or custody, who do they tend to reach out to for help then?
It's really interesting. Most people try to solve problems by themselves. And then if they ask for help, they go to their family and friends, which if you think about yourself when you have a problem, that's what you do. You ask people who you trust. It's only about 25 or 30% of problems where people will reach outside that immediate network that they have. And then they don't usually go to law. They go to the kind of place you go when you're in trouble. So it might be a community organization. It might be a membership organization. So AARP, for example, helps a bunch of people who are facing justice
problems.
People
might go to their church, maybe?
Absolutely. So if you're a member of a faith community, when the chips are down, you know, that's where we go. And so you go to your pastor or your mom to ask for some kinds of help solving this problem that you think about as a problem of life, because that's how you experience it.
Why is it important for people to understand that these are legal problems?
Well, because they often have rights that are at stake. So, for example, one big legal problem that low-income people have, they often have wage and hour jobs. So they're often eligible for overtime if they work over 40 hours, weekends, nights, that kind of thing. And employers don't always pay them overtime. And so you might experience that as my employer is a jerk who's not paying me what I'm supposed to be paid. But it's actually a legal problem called wage theft. And there are federal agencies and state agencies and lawyers who can assist you in getting back the money that you earned by working. But if you don't recognize that it's a legal problem, you might never reach out and try to get their help.
I'm speaking with Rebecca Sandifer, who's a 2018 MacArthur Foundation Fellow, and we're talking about her work. She teaches in the Department of Sociology. She's a sociologist at the University of Illinois. Rebecca, so that's the problem. Are there people who are working to change access in this area? Because I think we hear a lot about people who are trying to reform the criminal justice system, trying to help people in the criminal justice system with access. Are there people who are doing this in the civil justice system, if that exists?
Absolutely. And one of the most, I think, interesting and promising things that people are trying around the country are different experiments where you use people who are not fully qualified attorneys to do some of the things that attorneys used to do. So in California, California is a giant state. It has a lot of people. It runs a lot of people through the civil courts for evictions, for divorces. And most of those folks don't have lawyers. And so they don't know how to fill out their paperwork and what the process is and what the order of events is. So California created a program called Justice Corps. And they recruit college students and they give them a small educational grant. And they're trained to assist people with a specific kind of justice problem. They have these cute little T-shirts that mark them out. I mean, they're very, you know, they're visible, authorized, institutionalized sources of support provided by people who aren't lawyers. And in a very diverse state like California, they also provide a lot of important interpretation service because California cannot possibly staff enough interpreters for the folks in courts who need them. So by recruiting from the communities, from the communities that the court serves, the court's better able to give people access to what is really our public justice system.
And how does that make a difference, having people, whether they're actual lawyers or people who are trained to help? I imagine that makes a big difference.
It makes a big difference because often what people just need to do is move through the steps that the law has said you have to go through to achieve the goal, to get the eviction off your record, to expunge your criminal record, to get the child custody agreements in place so that your divorce is final and you can move on and get on with your life. And you often don't need a lawyer, per se, to help you do that. You just need someone who understands what the steps are and what your choices are and can help you think about them.
Does Illinois have any programs like this?
To my knowledge, Illinois doesn't have any big non-lawyer programs. There are lots of legal aid offices that use non-lawyers under the supervision of attorneys to assist people with different kinds of justice problems, and I'm sure that's going on in Illinois.
We've been talking with 2018 MacArthur Foundation Fellow Rebecca Sandifer. She teaches at the University of Illinois. Christina Olson is also on the line with us from Washington State. She's a research psychologist at the University of Washington. We are talking to her because she's an Urbana era area native. Christina, so I forgot to say welcome back to Illinois, at least to our airwaves. Christina,
thank you very much.
Your research focuses on children and how children think and are socialized. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I study how children think about social categories around them, so race and gender and social class, things like that.
And what led you to work specifically with stigmatized populations?
Well, I started work most recently on with transgender and gender diverse kids, in part because there was kind of a hole in the literature. There's a group of kids out there who are living in line with their identified gender, which is different from the sex they were declared at birth by the doctor. And this is really the kind of first cohort of kids having this unique experience. And I wanted to document what that experience looks like in order to shed light on what gender means kind of today, as well as to understand some of the challenges that uniquely face this group of young people.
And so that's the Olson Lab Trans Youth Project. This is a pretty large and it's also a long-term study of transgender kids and youth. What ages are the kids you're working with? Where are they from? And how long do you plan to study them?
So all the children in our longitudinal study start in the study when they're 3 to 12 years of age, and we're hoping to follow them for 20 years until the time they themselves are young adults and kind of maybe getting married or choosing to have children or not. And I think these kids are in 45 U.S. states and several Canadian provinces, and we fly around the country meeting with them and their families to learn about what their sense of themselves looks like, as well as their mental health and well-being.
Wow. What have been some of your biggest findings so far when it comes to especially very young, the younger children that are in that you are looking at?
Well, I'd say there are two main findings we found so far. And both of them can be kind of summarized as it's really remarkable, these children who feel very strongly like that they identify as girls or boys, kind of binary genders, they look remarkably like other kids who feel they are those genders, but that we kind of never questioned their identity claim. So we see that their gender development looks statistically indistinguishable, say a trans girl from any other girl. And we also see that their mental health is really good as well. Our kids do not show the kind of big impairments in anxiety and depression that we often see in trans and gender diverse adolescents and adults who have had really different lives than these young people I'm following have had. That is, our kids have transitioned to live as their gender very early in development, something that very few, if any, adults who are identify as trans today had that chance when they were young.
So I wonder if that was surprising to you when you, particularly the mental health component, because I think conventional wisdom, what we hear, what we see in news reports or what we read about this might suggest otherwise in terms of mental health issues.
Yeah, I would say I was surprised just how well the kids in our cohort are doing. And I think, to be clear, I think the way I interpret it as this is kind of an existence proof of the fact that, you know, you can have large groups of trans folks who have good mental health. Now, these kids have a lot of other supports in their lives as well. And so this doesn't suggest that, you know, if you transition, your life is perfect or anything. But I think these suggest that at least for kids who have a lot of supports around their family, often their schools, and a lot of other things going for them, resources and whatnot, that you can really separate well-being from trans identity, which for a long time people kind of looked at the fact that trans adults have very high rates of anxiety, depression, suicidality as a sign that this was some sort of mental disorder. But of course, now we can see that actually when you take away some of those stigmas and things, you actually see a group of kids who are doing pretty well.
So I wonder what it means to be doing the work at this time, because I feel like even maybe a couple of years ago, it might have been a really different conversation around this.
Yeah, and actually it's kind of been changing even over the 5 years that we've been working on this study. So when we started, I think most people hadn't even thought of the fact that a child could be transgender, and now we have, you know, National Geographic a year or two ago had a trans girl on the cover. We see a lot more discussion than we did. There's laws are changing and whatnot. So there's much more public discussion. And then kind of most recently, we see some also increasing pushback about that as well.
And for both of you, Christina, part of the reason you're doing this research is because it's so limited, right? Are there other people who are doing work in this area?
Increasingly, there are more and more people, you know, realizing that this is an important area or for whom there are personal connections to the work. So, yeah, I think it's really exciting to be part of this kind of wave of people that are becoming interested in this topic. And I think that's another reason why it'll be interesting to use this as a chance to also open up other doors and avenues for new work that isn't getting the attention it deserves.
And Rebecca, I imagine the same thing for you in a completely different sphere as we're thinking about civil justice issues.
It's been somewhat off the radar for a long time, and so there's a small band of people working on it, and this is a great opportunity to draw more folks in.
That's Rebecca Sandifer, who is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Christina Olson as well, a research psychologist at the University of Washington. Rebecca, Christina, congratulations again, and thanks for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
Oak Park, this school is crazy. It's like a social experiment.
In this community, there are levels of diversity, but we mentioned race, all hell breaks loose.
That's part of the 10-part documentary series from Cartemquin Films called America to Me. It's a series exploring race, education, and high school through the lens of a handful of students who attend Oak Park and River Forest High School. Oak Park's a western suburb of Chicago bordering the city's Austin neighborhood. An award-winning filmmaker, Steve James, has turned his filmmaking eye from everything from Hoop Dreams to Roger Ebert's life, and he's the director and executive producer of the America to Me docuseries. On the line with us now from Oak Park to tell us more about it. Hi, Steve. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, great to be here.
So Chicago stories have been such a part of your career, but this is a docuseries about your community, Oak Park, River Forest. Was it hard for you to turn the camera on your own town?
Well, people have joked that, you know, when the series comes out, where do I plan to move? But I think the portrayal of the high school in the community is balanced for sure. Yeah, it was tricky. I mean, for years, I've thought it would be interesting to look at this community and look at it through the high school to examine issues of race and achievement and how they play out in a liberal community where they still, nonetheless, have struggled around issues of equity. And so that was always the idea. I never thought it possible to do the film because I just figured the school would never allow us in. And then I found out a few years ago from John Conney, who's a teacher at the school and came on board as a producer, series producer, is that the decision about whether to make the series or make a film about the high school was really not up to the school itself. It's up to the school board, which is made up of community members. And lo and behold, we were able to convince them to let us in.
Mm. And so I wanted to ask you about the name of the series, America to Me. This is a reference to a Langston Hughes poem, correct? Called Let America Be America Again?
Yes.
When did you first encounter that poem?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I heard the poem many, many years ago because it is a, you know, within his body of work, I think it is a considered one of his more significant poems. But I hadn't heard it in many, many years. And at some point when I was trying to sit down, we were well into making the series and didn't feel like we had a title, right? And so I started to really try to think about, well, what should the title of this series be? And, you know, one of the things you do when you're trying to come up with a title often is that you start to look at your own material and see if there's something in there that sort of jumps out as the title. And we did some of that, and nothing seemed to click. You know, for me, sometimes titles come very quickly and easily, and I even have them before the project started. For instance, Hoop Dreams was a title I had before we even shot anything. Or when I did the film The Interrupters, that was a title that I had before we even shot anything. But sometimes they're real labor to come up with. So in this case, I decided to start looking at poetry about the Black experience in America, you know, and see if there was something there that just would grab me. And when I revisited this poem, it really just, it grabbed me. And that phrase, America to me, within the poem, just really leaped out, in part because of how it reflects the overall meaning of the poem, but also because in this series, what we see this series as being at its heart is what is America today through the eyes of these kids that we are following, who are mostly in the film Black and biracial, and what is their America? And so we love the intimacy of that name, America to Me, as well as the sort of broader implications of what the series is about.
Right. And so the context of that poem, part of it is just Langston Hughes writing, I say it plain, America was never America to me, and yet I swear this oath, America will be. And to that point, as you're thinking, I do really think a lot of this is about identity, whether that's how the kids perceive themselves or how adults perceive them. And you follow a whole cast of different students throughout this 10-episode run. And in a school, I mean, Oak Park River Forest has got, what, more than 3,000 kids? How did you go about finding the central characters that you picked?
It was not easy. You know, I've never done a film before where I engaged in a kind of casting process like this. It's just not the way I've worked, but that was required here. And so John Conney, who I mentioned earlier, and I began getting the word out in the community that this series was something we were making and we were looking for subjects. He consulted with certain teachers to say, you know, if you have students that you think would be great for this, can you please pass on our information to them? And if they want to reach out, they reach out. And you know, in multiple ways, we went on Facebook, you know. And what it resulted in is that we conducted about 40 interviews with potential candidates and their families in the months over the summer leading into the beginning of production. And out of that, we selected 12 kids that we thought would be great candidates and then presented them to our larger creative team to kind of weigh in on. And from that, we picked 7 kids to start with. But I knew that we were going to want to pick up kids along the way and leave us the opportunity to do that. And so by the end of this series, we're following actually 12 kids.
Mm-hmm. And then you also, most of the kids that you feature are predominantly African-American or biracial, but then there are also a few white students. Brendan and Caroline are a couple that are introduced. At what point did you realize you wanted to make sure that you had a couple different races presented in this?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. You know, Shayla Holland, who was the assistant principal at the school when we were trying to get the project underway and who was enormously insightful and influential in terms of our thinking about the series. She said to me at some point in the late spring, early summer, that if we really want, and this comment is basically in the series because we interviewed Shayla, you know, that if you really want to understand equity, you have to follow white kids, not just black and biracial kids, that we're all part of the system. And so really it was her, at her behest and influence, that we started a process of trying to look for white kids as well. What was interesting about that is that we really didn't get that process earnestly underway, honestly, until right around the beginning of the school year. And I did not anticipate how difficult it would be to find a lot of candidates. I think what happened is,
I mean, the demographic makeup of the school is predominantly white, right?
Yeah, the school is 54% white. It's about 27% black, 9 to 10% Latino, and you know, whatever's left over, other. You know, I did not anticipate the difficulty that we would have with that. And in part, I think what happened is that, and we know because we heard this in different ways, is that there were, you know, a lot of white families at that point, they knew that this was a series that was going to look critically at equity and education in Oak Park. There's a lot of sensitivity around that. And I think that a lot of white parents felt like they didn't want to take the risk of being subjects in a series like this because that we might hold them up for ridicule in some way or as an example, as Caroline says at one point, who we do follow. She heard a student say, they're just going to hold you up as an example of white privilege. Like, why are you doing this? And, you know, that was not something, frankly, that I wanted to do at all. We wanted to treat the white subjects with the same care and empathy and understanding that we treat our black and biracial students. But there was that fear out there. And interestingly, we didn't really hear from anyone that I would say was really wealthy in the community. And there are a number of very wealthy white families in the community of Oak Park and especially River Forest as well. And I think especially there, people were like, I'm not going to have my lifestyle put on display in a series that's looking at these issues. You know, the thing about living in a liberal community is that people have a high level of awareness around how they look and how they speak about race, and that can make people extremely cautious. It's frankly one of the problems, I think, that happens in liberal America, which is that people don't really engage in really candid and honest conversations about their real feelings about race because people worry so much about how they will come off if they say something that's at all critical or could be perceived negatively.
My guest is Steve James. He's the director and executive producer of America to Me. To that point, Steve, I wanted to play a little clip from the series here. This is Glenn Singleton, and he speaks at conferences around the country, and you're going to hear part of that as well as his interview with you.
We sit in a country that really hasn't decided yet that it wants students of color to achieve at a high level.
I have to break it down. No, 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 no. When you get to Harvard, you now have Harvard racism. When you go to medical school, you get medical school racism. So that's why when Obama got elected, we started to know what presidential racism is.
What I've discovered about white liberal people is their liberalness only goes as far as when it starts to challenge their situation personally. That's the Oak Park River Forest community.
That's Glenn Singleton speaking to Steve James, who's the executive producer and director behind America to Me, a docuseries. Steve, to that point, I wonder what you were just saying in terms of how hard it was to get some white families involved. This is an uncomfortable conversation for a lot of people, whether they're white or black or biracial or Asian. How tough was it to navigate through that?
Well, in my experience, and not just with this series, but a number of other films I've done that have grappled in differing ways with race in this country, starting with Hoop Dreams, but not just Hoop Dreams, I have found over the years that for many of the black people that I have encountered in the course of my filmmaking is that they don't have the same struggle or reticence about talking about race. And that, you know, I think is in part due to the fact that race is such a primal and central part of their lived experience. And so they've had plenty of opportunity to not just deal with racism and deal with microaggression and all the things that, that go into being living in a contemporary society like the United States. But they also, they think about it a lot because they have to deal with it. And so they have a lot to say about it when you give them an opportunity to speak to it. And that's not true for a lot of white people in my experience. And some of that is, again, like I was saying earlier, some of that is, if you're liberal, is a reluctance to speak out for fear of saying the wrong thing, wanting to be say the right thing. Glenn Singleton said to me in the interview, this is not in the series, is that, you know, he is often found with his white friends is that they are very fragile when it comes to discussions of race, that if he calls them on something that they've said and sort of says, you know, that's really kind of racist, they get really upset and hurt almost, and then he feels like he has to take care of them because they're friends, that they can't just sort of accept the fact that they have these blind spots and then engage with it in a candid and honest way, right? And I think that happens a lot in the white community. And then, of course, there are many of, you know, any time a white person tells you they have no racist attitudes at all, they're, in my view, they are not in touch with who they are. We all have them, no matter how liberal we may be. And I think that makes people very uncomfortable if they come to realize that. And of course, it manifests itself in really unproductive ways, I think, at times, which is that people then don't do anything. They feel like, you know, they'd rather do nothing and just live in a liberal place like Oak Park and feel like that's enough and try to harbor the right attitudes than actually actively go out and try and make real change.
And there's a line that is in one of the beginning episodes that diversity isn't the same thing as equity. And I wonder how much of this is about explaining that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You know, Oak Park is a very diverse community, and it has enormous pride in its history around diversity and the ways in which it thwarted white flight and integrated rationally. And all that's, you know, rightfully something to feel proud of. But just because you're a diverse community doesn't mean you're an equal community. And that's certainly true of Oak Park. And of course, it's true of the entire United States. You know, we're talking about Oak Park, but everything that's going on in Oak Park, you know, is true of everywhere. I think one of the things that makes the series, I hope, more unique is that Oak Park, being such a liberal community with a very well-funded public school system and a diverse community, you know, it's the kind of place where one would hope that there would be have been greater progress on these issues. But I think what the series, in a way, shows is that there are deep-seated reasons why change is so hard in this country, even under the best of circumstances.
I just had a conversation with one of your other Cartemquin colleagues, Bing Liu, about what it was like to have Hulu pick up his film after he did it. You all, after American to Me premiered at Sundance, Starz has picked it up for distribution. Do you feel like you still had to get it all funded? So I wonder, having all of these other outlets, if that makes a difference or it's making it easier to do the kind of work that you like to do.
One of the economics of series now, which is a good thing, is there's a lot of docuseries now coming out. And I think from a broadcaster's standpoint, what's appealing about that is that you can, for, you know, you get more bang for the buck for the money, if you will. You get multiple episodes of a series that then ultimately ends up being cheaper, you know, per hour, say, or minute even, than if they were buying a standalone documentary. And, you know, we are in the midst of an incredible golden age of television, and, you know, not only in the drama and scripted side of things, but now I think with documentary. And I think it just allows for a much more expansive, nuanced, and complex storytelling in the documentary community.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Steve James about America to Me. Stay tuned. You're listening to a special encore edition of The 21st.
Thanks for tuning into this encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Chicago filmmaker Steve James. He's the director and executive producer of a 10-part docuseries that came out in 2018 called America to Me. It's about Oak Park and River Forest High School, and it came out on Stars last August, but you can still stream it now on Amazon or Sling TV. There's a handful of students in the 2015-2016 school year that he follows, and we've been talking to him about issues of race, education, and how all of this has played out in his hometown.
One of the school board members said, how are you possibly going to do everything you want to do in a single film? And, of course, I made the joke that, you know, have you seen my films? They tend to be long. And they laughed, but I said, but more seriously, I think you make an excellent point. And I made a promise to them there. I said, I can't guarantee this because we now, if you approve us to go forward, we have to go find funding. And finding a series is harder than funding a single film. But I said, we will make every effort to make this a miniseries because I agree with that. And we were fortunate to find great partners in both the MacArthur Foundation here in Chicago, but and then much more significantly with the Participant Media that allowed us to do just that. And you're right, it's sort of, you know, if you're making a two-hour film, I think we would have been forced to either focus on two or three students, perhaps, which wouldn't have reflected the sort of wide variety of experience that the kids we were able to select did. Or we would have had to have made it, you know, much less of following the stories of kids' lives and much more of a kind of, you know, issue-oriented documentary that's just focused on, you know, the sort of nuts and bolts of these issues, which is not something I wanted to do. It's not the kind of work I like to do anyway. Mm. So the series allows us to follow multiple storylines, including the school as an institution, as well as the kids and the families of the kids, and yet also have passages in the film where we become a bit more analytic about the issues.
Steve James is on the line with us from Oak Park, where we're talking about this docuseries, America to Me. And Steve, I think when you think about the demographics of Oak Park in the community, biracial families are a significant part of Oak Park and also of the student population at the school. And your work features not just biracial families, but students and teachers, and especially of Ms. Stovall, who's one of your main teacher characters. Do you think those stories are told enough in America?
Not at all, no. I think it is one of the profound demographic shifts going on in this country and maybe around the world as well. You're right. Oak Park is a magnet for biracial families. I read somewhere that we have something like six times the national average of biracial families in the community, which is pretty phenomenal. And that was why it was vitally important that we reflect that in the series as well. And so we have, you know, we have a black-white biracial family. We have a
black and Asian.
Mm-hmm. We have a black Asian. And then in part two of the series, we have a white Mexican family. Student who becomes a central character. And yes, I think the experience of being biracial in this country, there's so much more to be done with it. I feel like we do our best to really try to address the individual experiences of the kids we're following. And with Jess Stovall, the teacher you mentioned, she's an incredible story, I think, in the series because she's someone who readily acknowledges that she grew up culturally white in a virtually all-white community in upper Wisconsin. And she has, over the years, had to kind of learn how to be black. And now she finds herself in a school where being a black teacher has often been being lacking power and empowerment. Being a black woman in that school, they, you know, is talked about in the series as not being something that translates into empowerment, in which is, I'm sure, surprising to a lot of people and will be to them in the community. Mm. So she's really kind of gets it from both ends, in a sense.
And there's this heartbreaking scene with her where she talks about, I think it's an aspect we don't think about with teachers and violence and how teachers, we hear so much about children and the impact of violence on children when children are killed or shot. But then she presents a really interesting side of teachers and the guilt that she grapples with as a teacher when she has a student who is a gang member who ends up being killed after he leaves the school. I think that's also an interesting aspect of
violence that we don't hear very much about.
Yes, of how it impacts people that were in the lives of those young people in this case, and the guilt that she felt about maybe she didn't do enough, you know, to help. And I think that all, you know, she cares so deeply about the kids she teaches, and that shows up in every aspect, I think, of how you see her in this film. One of the kids that's a major character is Kashan, who is in her English class, her American Lit class. And he is a bright kid, a very bright kid, very funny, but not, for the most part, very engaged with doing school. No one in his family has graduated.
Which she very admits in a very charming way.
Yes. No one in his family has graduated high school, let alone college. His mom went to the high school and was basically kicked out of OPRF years earlier. And Jess will just not give up on Kashan. And as the series progresses, you see her get drawn more and more into his story and a kind of commitment to seeing him not just pass this class, but stay engaged in school.
I want to bring up another character in the series, the physics teacher, Mr. Podolner. And this is a longer clip we're going to play, but it's a conversation Mr. Podolner is having with two of his students, Charles and Jada.
You can take a class or you can teach black kids, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean like you necessarily know everything there is
sure.
about race.
Yeah.
That's what confused me about the memoir, because it seemed like you had like a conscience about race in America, mm-hmm. but it didn't reflect how you are in classroom.
When I see black students in my class, I kind of label it as an extra priority because I know what you guys have been with.
Okay, so I have an issue with that. Maybe you shouldn't, not saying like, oh, you should see us all as equal. Well, yeah, kind of. You should just see us as your students. So it's like, oh, this is my black student, so I'm gonna have to check and jive with her and try to see if I can relate. And it's just like, it's based off of stereotypes.
I know that you've experienced racism, and I know you've been treated ways because you don't look like other people. So one of my goals, if I want to raise the achievement of my black students, which is significantly lower in your physics class, I have to do something so that they have the comfort level to be in the class. Now, the things I've done with you have made you uncomfortable.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Right.
Because that can ruin my whole day. It can make me think about that for the rest of the day.
Right.
That, no, I think that's a no. Like a no-no. Like, you shouldn't do that.
You know, what you're telling me is kind of different than what we're hearing from our, quote, racial leaders at the school and administration. They're telling us we should talk about race all the time with all our students in every single class, not just like during the African-American, you know, History Month.
But when you guys talk about race in class, it is not serious. Race isn't serious. Like, you make jokes and stuff about it, and it's just like, that's what makes me really angry. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a sensitive subject that you shouldn't be, like, you know.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It may be because I'm just a naturally joking person, but, like, with racism, it's like, yo, it exists, but some of it is kind of funny. Because with me,
no,
I don't.
No, it's not.
That's my opinion.
It's not
funny. I'm entitled to my opinion.
Oh, my
just
God.
Like you said. I feel like for me, I don't really care about it because if I don't feel like I'm directly being.
I feel like when you do that, you make white people comfortable to say stuff, and then it's just going to continue on and on and on.
Well,
and
what
on.
Have we been doing for
exactly,
100 and some
because
odd...
we keep.
Fam,
okay.
Bro, calm down. Look, if we
should
gonna
we talk
something,
more about
I'm
it?
Sorry.
Let's continue.
It's nothing positive talking about race. It's nothing that you can be possibly happy about.
Right.
That's Jada, Charles, and their physics teacher, Mr. Podolner, at Oak Park River Forest High School. And that's from America to Me, the docuseries we've been talking about. Steve, just as we wrap up this conversation, I think that gets to some of the nuances of what we're talking about. And I wonder, for you, having spent so much time with these students, and as this being sort of the latest filmmaking effort that you've made to that looks at race in America, what are you hoping people will take away from this?
Oh gosh, it's a 10-hour miniseries. There's a lot I would love for people to take away. I'm really pleased that you played that whole scene because I think you're right. It's a really strong and complex conversation going on there, because on the one hand, you have Mr. Podolner,
who is incredibly well-intentioned. He had shared with both Jada and Charles, which he's done with other students in the past, his racial memoir of growing up in Oak Park and grappling with race. And it's a, you know, it's a very candid account of what he was going through. It's the kind of candid, you know, account that you wish more, you know, white people would at least take on, right? That he does that, and he shares it with them and wants to hear their thoughts about it. And he gets along great with Charles, who comes in at the end of that scene to disagree with Jada some. He has found a rapport with Charles that is, you know, that is really works for both Charles and for Mr. Padoner. He has not found that rapport with Jada at all, clearly, and you get that from the scene. And what she's trying to say there is that not all black people are the same, right? And you can't, what may work for Charles is not going to necessarily work for other kids of color when it comes to issues of talking about race and engaging with their education. And I think that's one of the fundamental things that I think I hope will come through in the series is that equity is not an easy thing and to achieve, and it's not the same thing as equality. In other words, if you treat all black kids the same in an equal fashion, you're not going to get the same results. Black kids, just like white kids, any kids, they're individuals, and they need to be addressed and dealt with a kind of consciousness around race, but also as individuals. And I think one of the problems Oak Park has is that despite its great intention, its good intentions, as reflected by teachers like Mr. Padoner, it struggles with how to really meaningfully impact their education in positive ways because there's just there's a lot of disconnect going on.
What kind of feedback have you heard back from people in the community about this?
The sense I got is that the community, on the one hand, was relieved to see a lot of great things that the school is doing and great teaching that's going on in the school. And I think they were taken with the lives of the kids that we followed. They're, you know, they're kids that I think really you connect with and you're pulling for. They were also, at the same time, I think, bothered and rightfully so, about some of the criticisms that are implied in there and strongly stated in those first couple of episodes. So, you know, I think it's going to be a really interesting journey. The school and the community are committing to once a week as this rolls out, watching the episodes and then coming together for conversations that the school at least hopes will be part of really making for more significant change that you know, in the school and in the community. And I hope they're right about it.
If you're interested in screenings, I know if people are interested around Illinois, Cartem Quinn possibly could do that too, right, Steve?
Yes. So I have a website address that they can go to if they want to become part of impact and outreach around the series, which is americatometerealtalk.com.
We will put that on our website. We'll tweet it out if folks are interested. Steve James, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed the conversation.
That does it for us today. If you have the NPR One app, you can download that for wherever you get your smartphone apps. It's a good way to find past shows. It's pretty simple to download. Then you can set your home station. And if you search for the 21st to follow us, it's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the hour with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. Our Facebook page, if you want to search for the 21st to like us, is another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Vishesh Anand, Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.